May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jonathan Sternberg for Relator John Doe. As Your Honors know, the Relator challenges the constitutionality of two non-appealable orders that the trial court entered, which changed the Relator's probation status to that of sex offender and ordered treatment as such. It is the Relator's position that these orders exemplify a retrospective application of law, which our Constitution prohibits. In Doe versus Blunt last year, and again in RL versus Missouri Department of Corrections a couple months ago, this court held that newly prescribed probation conditions cannot retrospectively be applied to a probationer who pleaded guilty before the General Assembly prescribed that condition.
What if these new conditions that were imposed were not a part of a newly enacted statute? They were just new conditions that the Board of Probation and Parole decided to place upon on your client. Would you still be here complaining?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, I would.
Well, what if that were, to follow up on her question, what if that were based upon some behavior that became a concern of the probation officer and goes back in and says, look, this guy is acting inappropriately and we've got to put him through some paces or else I think I'm going to violate him and bring him back in?
In that case, Your Honor, that would be appropriate as long as that condition existed in the law, somewhere in the law at the time.
No, but I mean, when you have somebody on probation, and in this case he's on probation for endangering the welfare of a child by having inappropriate sexual conduct with a child, if the probation officer discerns that he is hanging around playgrounds or doing something that looks like it might be a repeat of the behavior for which he's on probation, doesn't the probation officer have the right to go to the court and say, we need to impose some further restrictions on this person, or else I'm going to find some violation here, I'm going to bring him in, and you can send him to prison?
Probation officers always have discretion under 217.705 to suggest new conditions of probation to the court based on whatever they discretionarily see.
Right. But in this case, was there any further behavior that caused the imposition of these?
There was no further behavior that caused the imposition.
So what I'm talking about is a different case.
I'm sorry.
I'm talking about a different case than a person who does have behavioral issues during the period of his probation. Because the purpose of probation is to keep somebody from committing another crime.
Of course. That would be... I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Finish your answer.
That would be appropriate, but once again, the probation officer can't just dream up whatever he or she wishes. There still has to be some legislative or administrative rule promulgating that sort of condition.
Or change in behavior or... and I'm not saying that the defendant has to break the rules of his probation, but some type of behavior, as Judge Wolf is indicating, that shows maybe he's got the propensity or the continuing
that,
to...
That brings up an interesting point. One could argue that since retrospective law only is retrospective if it imposes new disabilities, obligations, and duties with opposed to a past transaction, it would no longer be a past transaction in the case that you're suggesting. The transaction would change from the probationer's guilty plea to that new disturbing behavior.
But you're saying you couldn't use for conditions of probation to say, okay, register as a sex offender even though it's not an offense for which you're supposed to register, because that would be inconsistent with the law that says only these particular people register.
Exactly.
As sex offenders.
And that's basically what this court held in Doe v. Blunt. In Doe v. Blunt, a probationer was required as a condition of probation, not in some other respect, to register as a sex offender. When he failed to do so because his crime hadn't been added to the list at the time that he pleaded guilty, a probation violation report was filed, just like in this case. The only difference being that in that case, John Doe used a declaratory judgment procedure instead of a writ of probation.
Was that a condition of probation, though?
It was a condition of his probation, which was retroactively applied in that case to Mr. Doe by the Department of Probation and Parole.
And is that what happened? What happened here? It's unclear to me.
No, that can't be.
Okay.
It's the judge that
imposes conditions of probation, not the Department of Probation and
Parole. One of the conditions of all probation.
Was this guy on parole?
Probation. This was probation as well.
They both were. Okay.
Yes, exactly. One of the conditions of probation, even regular non-sex offender, an ordinary probation for somebody who commits a misdemeanor or felony, is that they must obey all state and federal laws. It was that provision in Doe versus Blunt that wound up with the probation violation because he was no longer following all state and federal laws.
Frankly, that, to my recollection, this issue was not raised in Doe versus Blunt.
The particularity of whether a trial court or a probation officer has discretion, that wasn't brought up, no. But if this court accepts that argument, then effectively Doe versus Blunt is gutted. The probation on retrospective laws is gutted.
No, it's not gutted because it could be after the person is discharged from probation that that law would apply, and we said it doesn't.
It very well could be. But in this case, what we're looking at are a plethora of new probation conditions, which all have some root in a law that was enacted after.
Are you saying that the judge cannot impose additional conditions of probation later on during the term of probation?
A judge certainly can, but the essence of, say, the Stussy case is that there must be some sort of legislative authority to do so. Probation itself results only from legislative authority. There was no probation until the legislature authorized as much. And the Supreme Court of the United States held in 1916 that you can't have probation unless...
But is there anything that says that it doesn't a judge have discretion to determine the conditions of probation that he imposes upon a person, especially in an SIS?
Absolutely.
Now, why would this be an impermissible condition, regardless of whether any law is subsequently passed? Why couldn't this judge have done this anyway?
He couldn't have done it anyway because there was no legislative authorization to impose these particular conditions.
Well, there's not legislative authorization to do lots of things that are required as conditions of probation.
I thought the judge can impose any probation so long it's tailored to the offense and so long that it's not otherwise.
There's not a legislative list of things you got to check off.
No, certainly there isn't.
So why is this prohibited?
This is prohibited because there was no provision anywhere at the time that the relator pleaded guilty that the crime was a sex offense. Now, hear me out. Missouri has two categories of sexual offense. There are only two ways you can be a sexual offender. One has existed since the 1970s, and the other one has existed since 1995 when they promulgated the Sex Offender Registration Act. The first way is for your crime to be located in Chapter 566, which is denominated sexual offenses. The second way is, since 1995, for your crime to be added to the Sexual Offender Registration Act. At the time the relator pleaded guilty, in this case, there was no legislative prescription that the crime was a sexual offense in any way. In fact, moreover, there was no differentiation between endangerment of a child of a sexual nature versus not of a sexual nature.
Could I interrupt you for a second?
Certainly.
If in fact, the condition that was imposed was a treatment program, and that under the law for certain sexual offenders, there was a treatment program that was now available and required, and the judge decides, or at the recommendation of the probation officer, that this person should attend the treatment program. Is it part of your argument that that would be prohibited because there's now a statute that says you have to do it? You're saying a judge could never do it based on the judge's discretion.
The judge couldn't have. That question, Your Honor, is analogous to State Ex Rel v. Stussy back in 1977. The question there was whether a judge, within his discretion, could order that a probationer undergo shock time. And the opposing argument to the idea that he couldn't was that judges have discretion to do whatever reasonably will help the probationer.
In this case, the judge could have done that at the time the judge initiated probation.
The judge could have
ordered.
He couldn't have ordered sex offender treatment because there was no provision allowing for sex offender treatment, neither in any administrative rule of the Department of Corrections nor in revised statutes.
And when I was a trial judge, I ordered probationers all the time to go to treatment that was provided locally, that was not required by statute.
And actually, I had the
discretion.
The probationer in this case underwent exactly that very same thing. It's something called the Over the Walls program,
right,
which was
valid. But my point is, simply because there is a statute that later compels it, doesn't take that remedy away, does it?
It does. When there was no provision anywhere whatsoever that, A, the crime was a sex offense, B, there was some difference.
What I'm trying to get at is it the nature of the condition, and is it the fact that it was a modification as opposed to an original? How do those two factors weigh in, and what is your legal basis for saying, limiting to the nature of the modified condition and the fact that it was a modification?
Certainly, Your Honor. Both of those factors play into the idea that this is a retrospective law or an ex post facto law. The first you mentioned was that it's the nature of it. Certainly, the nature of calling it sex offender probation, requiring him at his own expense to sit around with a group of people who could be from rapists to people who possess child pornography to something completely different, the nature did not exist in the law at the time that the relator pleaded guilty. Secondly, the discretionary aspect, there was no provision anywhere for people convicted of this specific crime to be included in discretionarily.
What are the restrictions? Under 217.705.3, what restrictions are there on a trial judge as to modifying the conditions? Because there was talk about in response to some behavior. Is there a requirement that the conditions can only be modified if it is justified by that, or can a court in its discretion change the conditions at any time?
A court certainly can change the conditions, but that doesn't mean it can change the conditions to whatever it wants. It can change the conditions to whatever existed in the law at the time that the relevant transaction took place. If the relevant transaction we're talking about is a change in behavior or some commission of an illegal act or a violation of previously existing conditions, then certainly that might change what the transaction is. In this case, though, there's never been any such allegation. The transaction to which we're referring is the guilty plea. Now, you ask what limits exist on a trial court. This court said in Nicholson v. State about 30 years ago that the liberty given to a person on conditional probation, parole, or pardon is subject to all conditions which are not illegal, immoral, or impossible of performance. In State ex rel. Stussy, the court held that State ex rel. St. Louis County v. Stussy, the court held that requiring someone to undergo shock time when there was no legislative provision for it was illegal.
Oh, it was Stussy, by the way.
Stussy. I didn't know that. Thank you.
And your time is up, counsel. You can continue in your rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Mike Spillane. I represent Judge Moore in this case. The first thing I'd want to point out is that there is a linkage between new conditions and something that happened. If one looks at the docket sheet, one will notice that all of these new conditions are imposed after investigative reports by probation and parole. Those aren't part of the record, but that seems to be the factor that's kicking it in.
Wasn't there something here, and maybe you can correct me if I'm incorrect, that the trial judge at first took out these conditions, and then probation and parole said, no, you have to. This is the only way we'll supervise this person?
Well, there was a couple.
Because that makes a big difference to me, as opposed to the judge think it's necessary. If probation tells them that's the only way we can supervise this person, then that's very different than the discretion we've been discussing.
There are a couple of things that happened here. First of all, sentencing and the imposition of original probation conditions occurred under a different judge than ended up supervising the case. I think if you read the conditions that were imposed originally, they're pretty broad. Now, there was back and forth on imposing new probation conditions. So the three new probation conditions, well, the first two that eventually came in were examination by a physician and supervision as one supervises a sex offender, and later the last one that was added was sex offender treatment. There was back and forth on these. The judge, in I believe March, issued a preliminary modification after receiving a report from probation and parole, adding these new conditions. Well, I don't remember the exact date, but it was at some point. And at that point, the judge said, you have 30 days to respond to these new conditions. They did. They backed the judge off of them, and he took them away, and then probation and parole came back and recommended them again.
And that's it. Did they say that under the law you have to impose this because of this crime? Because that's different.
No, that's not my understanding.
The retrospective application of the new statute.
That is not my understanding that anyone is under the misimpression that the new law requires this. Factually,
what did that report say then? Because I thought it said you have to do this.
Well, what we have is the docket sheets. We do not have the probation and parole reports as part of the record. Okay, and the docket sheets at one docket entry, which is the last one, I believe, which just replies to sex offender treat. Well, you have it in front of you. You can look at what it says. The last docket entry says something to the effect the Department of Probation and Parole insists on this and won't supervise them unless you do it. But in fact, I think he could order them to if he wanted to. They're pushing him one way.
You're not saying they had a right to insist. I mean,
no,
it doesn't matter.
Of course not.
Okay.
I think
that's what I wanted to clarify.
Yeah, I think what's happening is defense is pushing for less conditions, and probation and parole is pushing for more.
Right.
And at some point in the judge's discretion, probation and parole won the argument.
Okay.
And they were sending reports and so forth to back that up, and those are referenced in the docket sheet, but they're not part of the record. Let me say explicitly what the three conditions are, because I'm not sure we've established that. The three new conditions, which I am not sure were not implicit in the order originally issued that weren't challenged, were examination by a physician, sex offender treatment by a provider that was approved by probation and parole, and supervision as the department supervises sex offenders. Whatever way they supervise sex offenders, supervise this guy that way.
And just to clarify again, because it was unclear, at first it appeared when you requested to take the case that there was also a requirement of registration, but it appears from the briefs you're not saying there's a requirement
of
registration.
No, if one reads...
But in fact, there was a registration that he didn't do, but someone registered him.
That's outside of this case, and you may want to ask opposing counsel of that. I think they're fighting about registration with somebody else, not my client.
You're not saying you'd have authority because the statute says certain people can be registered, and you said you can't apply it retrospectively.
No. What I think he has to sign was a sex offender supervision agreement.
Right.
And my recollection of the language in that agreement is that one must apply by registration requirements that apply to the person by law. So if it doesn't apply to him by law, the sex offender registration, which it doesn't, then he wouldn't have to apply by it. So I mean,
and
I'm not sure that's an
issue. Doesn't apply to him by law. Okay.
No, I don't think that's an issue in the case. I think the thrust of their argument, it has two thrusts. The first one is that because endangering the welfare of a child by having sexual conduct with that child is in Chapter 568 as opposed to 566, therefore, you can't give any probation conditions that have to do with sex offenses. I think that's just plain wrong. That's like saying you can't give someone a requirement that they go to alcohol treatment if they committed burglary, or they can't require them to go to drug treatment, or you can't require them not to drink. Of course you can. They don't have to be convicted of the offense that has to do with an offense that is related to all of the felonies. They don't have to have a conviction that is directly related to banning them from something on probation. If you have somebody that has a problem with drinking and he gets convicted of burglary, of course you can say don't drink. So I think their argument on 568 and 566 is just wrong. Their argument seems to be that since the legislature put this thing in the chapter that's titled Offenses Against the Family instead of the one next door, which is sex offenses, that somehow you can't have any conditions of probation have to do with sex offenses. I think that's just wrong. So, I mean, I think that defeats the case right there. And I think their next argument is that since the legislature in June 2006 had some requirements that came in, such as sex offender registration for this particular offense, such as not living within 1,000 feet of a school if you've committed this particular offense, not going within 500 feet of a school, and I think there was one other one, access to home computers, that somehow makes any probation conditions wrong because they'd be permissible for new people. And of course, that's not right. It's like using the new laws that say this is a good thing for new people as a sword to say that you couldn't use your discretionary probation conditions to require the same or similar things for older offenses. Of course you could. You're not using any new power. You're using what you have.
And just to make sure I understood you, you're not saying he could be ordered not to live within 1,000 feet of the school. You're saying the fact that new requirement was imposed has nothing to do with the general kinds of conditions that a judge can impose.
I think I'm saying something more subtle than that. I think there's a new law that says it's a crime that if you committed this particular offense to live within 1,000 feet of a school.
But that law doesn't apply to him.
No, that doesn't apply to him. But I don't think that would make it improper for the probation officer to say, for the terms of your probation, I have determined in my discretion that you shouldn't live within 1,000 feet of a school.
And so he could say, in the terms of my probation, I think you have to register then, too, under that argument.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Because I think registration, one, is more divorced from rehabilitation than this is. I think this court has talked about that there are two primary purposes of probation. One is rehabilitation without incarceration. The other is protection of the public. I'm not sure registration, backed up by a criminal penalty, goes to rehabilitation so much as having and successful completion of probation so much as having a sex offender not live within 1,000 feet of a school if his probation officer thinks this is going to be a problem. I don't think a law that says if you're convicted of this offense in the future that you can't do that under criminal penalty takes away the probation officer's discretion to recommend to the court, hey, that's a bad idea for this guy.
But both of those concepts, registration and not living within 1,000 feet of a school, could very well be argued as falling within protection of the public.
I think, right, and I think there are two goals, rehabilitation and protection. And I think there's a line. And again, I agree with the previous arguments that the cases about registration weren't so much probation cases as they were criminal penalty cases, and I'm not sure this argument was made, but I think there's certainly a valid line that can be drawn between saying you have to register and get your name out there for the rest of your life.
And that's part of the question. If you register, could a person on probation be required to register during the period of probation? Is it then out there for the rest of their life? Mm-hmm. Or is it removed at the end of the probation?
Gosh, I think that if they had to register, I think they'd probably have to fight to get it off the list. But I'm not sure.
You're out there forever on the internet. Then.
Yeah, but I think I'm not sure that's applicable because nobody's asking him to register.
Right.
At least I don't. That's not the way I perceive it. Please.
Can you distinguish your facts from what we've said in Phillips, Blunt, and R.L.?
Yeah, I think all of those had to do with the perception that there was a criminal statute being violated. That's certainly the way I read them. I think the one that
has it was civil retrospective application of additional requirements. It's in violation of the civil requirement under our Constitution that you cannot retrospectively impose
exactly
additional
right. Exactly
duty.
Right.
It was not criminal.
But I mean, I think the distinction that I was making is in all of those cases, a new law that imposed the disability of either registration or, in one case, residency, with the sanction of criminal penalties was being applied, and that's not happening here. But I'm not sure. Did I address the distinction?
Your opponent argues it was because of the provision in probation, the standard provision that you have to obey all laws.
Exactly.
That's what triggered the compliance with those other
laws. In those cases, I think that's right. I mean, I think that's the distinction. I think you've hit it on the head. I think one of those cases was explicit. I think it was R.L., and I apologize if I got the initials wrong, but the residency case,
my
understanding was that probation and parole misunderstood that it would be a violation of the law requiring, the new law requiring people not to live within 1,000 feet of a school, and therefore they said you have to do it because you're violating the law if you don't. That's not the facts here. So I think that's the distinction between those cases and this case.
Well, the issue wasn't raised about whether this could be an independent condition of probation.
Well, I think that's accurate. I mean, I think there's two distinctions. One, if that would have been the issue, I think whoever was making the argument would be making the same argument that I am now. But two, I don't think that was the issue in the case because I think probation and parole misunderstood that the law required registration under criminal penalty and that the violation was violation of the law. I think that's what they understood, at least in the R.L. case. But you know, it's hard to tell from the opinion, but that's what I think they understood. Is there any questions that the court? Are there any questions? Oh, let me ask you mention one thing: the modification. Aziz versus McConnachie. That was the case that dealt with modification under 217.705.3. One of the things this court said was that modifications on probation can be done without a hearing, and then in talking about public policy. Well, it was a parole case, but the court also addressed and mentioned that the statute permitted modifications on the recommendation of a probation officer without a hearing. And this court said that that there was a policy reason for not putting constraints on those modifications. And that was that if you constrain what conditions the courts or the probation and parole officers in the case of parole can place on an offender, there are people that will be incarcerated that otherwise might not be if they could be subjected to conditions that made the court or the probation and parole officer comfortable. So I think there's, as this court talked about in Aziz, there's a policy for further discretion. And I would just argue the discretion goes way back. I think they were correct in saying illegal, immoral, or impossible. And certainly this isn't that. Certainly this is reasonably related to helping him complete his probation and at the same time safeguarding the public. So now I guess I'll ask the questions. I think I may have talked over someone. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
A couple points here. First of all, the reason the investigative reports are not in the record is they were never provided to any one of the relators' counsels at any time. They still have never been provided. Probation and parole refuses to provide them, and I don't know where else to go with that. As to Chapter 568 versus 566, that is not the general thrust of any of the relators' arguments. It's not because it's in one chapter versus another. It's because of what the state of this particular offense was at the time that the relator pleaded guilty. It was no different than any other Class C felony for which probation could be imposed. There was no, as part of the relator's original conditions of probation, unlike Respondent's counsel says, there was no condition that he be evaluated and treated by a physician. The judge currently supervising the case, is...
But I think the thrust of some of the questions is, pretend there were no new law that applied to him, and that would apply to a similar kind of offense. Couldn't the trial judge originally have said you have to see a doctor, or said, you know, you shouldn't live near a school? Pretend there's no law that required certain sex offenders to not live near a school and so forth. Just... as a condition of probation, it seems that it would be a good plan for this person not to be near school. Why does the later enactment of a statute barring certain people from living near school restrict the discretion that the judge would otherwise have?
Certainly, Your Honor. That particular statute, which I believe is 589.415, I could be wrong about that, though. That particular statute gives authority, expressly gives authority, to the Department of Probation, to the Department of Corrections, obviously to county prosecutors if the person is off probation, to enforce that. Most of these statutes give authority expressly. It says the Department of Probation and Parole or the Board of Probation and Parole shall have the authority. The negative connotation of that is that before this they did not have authority because all probation has to be prescribed by legislative authority.
So you're saying, but traditionally judges do impose many conditions they think are necessary. You're saying that sub silentio took away the court's discretion to impose conditions it otherwise could have?
No, Your Honor. Any one of those conditions that judges tend to impose are prescribed in some manner in either the White Book or the Orange Book of the Department of Probation and Parole. A judge couldn't do so unless there is some legislative enactment somewhere that allows them to do so. In this case, at the time the relator pleaded guilty, there wasn't. And I think exactly what you pointed out, Chief Justice Stitt, at the very beginning of Respondent's argument, that the judge didn't do this within his discretion, but rather on the request, because it appears that probation and parole requires that I do this, I hereby enact these conditions. That's a lot different than discretion. We aren't talking about discretion here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is submitted.